Blog Talk Radio.
What happens when you mix a boomer with a Generation X or a Y or a tween or a millennial? What are all these terms about anyway when you're talking about the workplace? And do you know the 7 trends you'll need to know to survive and thrive? Well, if you have questions about any of these terminologies that I've just thrown at you, you will want to listen to today's show. We have a great lineup for you in terms of multi-generational issues in the workplace, and then a fabulous international community festival out in Western Massachusetts. This is Carol Copeland Thomas, and you're listening to Focus on Empowerment. Welcome to today's show. I am really happy that you're with us, and we're warming up slowly here in Greater Boston. I hope that you're staying nice and warm and engaged wherever you happen to be. I love this format because we can broadcast anywhere, and you can listen to the show anywhere or anytime that you would like. We would love to have you and your friends to join us. If you'd like to join the chat room, feel free to. We have guests who always pop in and out of our chat room while the show is going on, and we also love for you to call our show at 646-727-2766. That's 647-646-727-2766. We will give you a little bit more information about our upcoming Empowerment Recognition Breakfast that will take place next Thursday at the Seaport Hotel in Boston on the waterfront a little bit later on with a very special message. And then we have a special tribute for Dr. Dorothy Height, who was funeralized a little bit earlier today, and I'll have some special words to say about her in really in tribute to her very long life but very rich life. And then our last segment today, we're going to really excite you with a lot of activities that go on in the western part of Massachusetts, which most people don't really think about, but they have a lot of diversity, spirit, and energy, and they have a wonderful event that's coming up this coming weekend from 12 until 4 at the Norman Rockwell Museum. You never knew that Norman Rockwell had a lot of contacts and lots of history in western Massachusetts, and we'll tell you all about that. But our first half of the show, I'm really excited to have my guest on. He has spoken all over the United States. He's been on many shows along with his co-author who wrote the book, The M Factor, How the Millennial Generation is Rocking the Workplace. And this is really a sequel to their first book, When Generation Collides. I'm really happy to bring to our airwaves from Minneapolis, Minnesota, David Stillman. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Carol.
Well, first of all, I want to just get a little sense of where the terminology millennial comes from. I'm a diversity professional of 23 years and actually was in Minnesota working the large diversity forum last month, so I know a little bit about this topic, but I'm always interested in new trends, and we want to hear about those 7 trends during our conversation together. We're familiar. Why don't you walk us through the different categories? Because people, sometimes they can understand, they know the word boomer, but they're probably saying, what is a boomer? What is a Generation Xer? So walk us through the various categories that lead to the millennials.
Absolutely. Well, starting with keeping in mind that today we have 4 generations working shoulder to shoulder, which is really unique because it's the first time it's happened in history.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got the traditionalist generation, born before 1946. That's the World War II generation,
mm-hmm.
the generation that is very loyal, patriotic, fiscally conservative, a lot of faith in institutions.
Right.
That definitely changed when along came the 80 million baby boomers, born between 1946 and 1964.
That's me.
80 million strong, that's right. This is the optimistic, idealistic generation that really created great change and took a lot of our institutions to the next level. The generation that said to traditionalists, we'll support the things you're doing, but we really think things need to change around here.
Mm-hmm.
And they challenged the status quo, and thank goodness they did, because they brought civil rights, human rights, voters' rights, women's rights, all to national attention.
Right.
But things definitely changed again when yet another generation came along, Generation X. And this is really where we saw a lot of collisions start to happen, because the baby boom generation, 80 million, had pretty much garnered the limelight in every life stage they entered.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Generation X showed up, they said, oh, they'll behave and act and think just like us. And Xers didn't, and whoa, did it backfire.
And the X kids are really, they're our kids. I mean, my daughters are X, they're in that category.
Sure, it's 1964 to 1981.
Right.
Is what we say. Interesting point about Generation X, dramatically smaller in terms of sheer numbers, 46 million.
Mm-hmm.
So you see 80 million boomers and then only 46 million Generation Xers.
Right.
And now what we have is a whole new generation showing up on the job. And that's why we wrote this new book, The M Factor, is because we realized when Gen X showed up, everyone tried to treat them like the boomers,
uh-huh.
and it backfired. Well, the leading edge of the millennials are now in our workplace, and already companies are trying to treat them like the previous generations, or they're assuming the older they get, they'll become more like everybody else, and it's just not true. And so this generation's, you know, very unique. You've also heard the term Generation Y.
Right.
Same generation as the millennials. The reason we don't call them Generation Y is they kept emailing our office or calling us saying they didn't like how that was just implying that they followed Generation X.
Interesting. Okay. I was going to
They
ask
wanted
you
their
that.
Own definitive name, and it was the turn of the century. It was one of their big events.
Uh-huh.
And that's how we picked the millennials. And it seems to be a phrase that has caught on as much as Generation Y. But we call them the millennials, but if you're comfortable or you know the term Generation Y, it is the same generation.
So you're also combining not only Generation Y with the tweens, because I've also heard conversations and read information about the tweens. So would I dare say that both the Y and the tweens have been combined to form the millennials?
Yeah, I would say 1982 to 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our youngest of the millennial set, you know, based on how we're defined, are 10 years old. And the oldest, you know, in their late 20s. And, you know, people who are, say, 10 years old are right on the cusp of the next generation. Just like we saw people who were born, say, in 1963, 64,
right.
tend to be on the cusp. They understand the boomers, but they also really relate to the Gen Xers. So, you know, people who are on the trail end tend to be right on the cusp of two generations.
Okay, so now we have the terminology and
yes.
the categories in place. Boomers, Generation X. And a traditionalist, should I say, because many of them they've retired and they're going back to work, or they're serving as of counsel or advisors, et cetera. Boomers who are leaving the workplace in record numbers or taking early packages, the Gen Xers and the millennials, which from my perspective include the Ys and the tweens. And as
yes.
you have said, all four of these groups are in the workplace at the same time. The older I grow, the more I realize how we get married to our own work styles, our own
yes.
way of life, and our own thinking. And that really can really cause some interesting dynamics in the workplace. I would dare say so, David?
I would definitely agree. Where it becomes very interesting, first of all, your perspective is needed.
Mm-hmm.
All the wonderful traits that your generation brings to the table, definitely needed. But
mm-hmm.
where we've got to be careful is that we don't assume everyone's looking through the same lens. So
yeah.
you said you're very comfortable in your own generational perspective. Where that gets in the way is, let's say you're in charge of a recruiting campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So you put together the whole campaign. More often than not, what we'll find a boomer will do is they'll design a campaign that would recruit who? But the boomers. And versus taking off your own generational lens and say, well, how would a millennial want to be recruited? What value propositions would they resonate to?
Right.
Where would they even go look for a job? And oftentimes people don't really realize that they need to take off their own generational lens and see where the other generations are coming from.
Well, yeah, I want to sort of belabor that point, because I think it leads us into a discussion about technology and how important it is. I'm sort of an early adapter, not really a total early adapter, but I do most of my work now using online capabilities, do a lot of research online, and now communicate and conduct meetings online, and now do this radio program online, having gone to a terrestrial radio station for 11 years. And what I have found, even in communicating information to people that I'm working with on a project, with the younger individuals, they really want to have their information delivered electronically. And yet those people in my age category still want a letter or they want a phone call. So how have you played that out in your book, The M Factor, in terms of how people want to communicate and have their information distributed?
This is a great question. This is where it becomes really important that you take off your own generational lens and look
mm-hmm.
at who you're communicating with. Let's first of all talk about those of us who are communicating with millennials. Absolutely. If you're reaching out to them for, you know, ideally maybe to recruit them or you're reaching out to them for a project, yeah, they are going to probably go to social networks.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to prefer texting. We're seeing, like, for example, an insurance company that's doing quotes for a project now, they'll send it to a text right to a millennial's iPhone, or right to their mobile device. So what the insurance company did that was smart.
Memo.
They said, what's that?
Forget the traditional memo that used to go out 20 years ago.
Well, that's just it. So what the insurance company was being so savvy about is they said, okay, we're communicating with millennials. Let's send it to them how they want to receive it.
Yeah.
The problem we run into now with the millennials, which we've covered in our book and the advice we give to the millennials in the M Factor, is millennials often need to realize that they might be communicating with a boomer or traditionalist who are going to want that handwritten note,
mm-hmm.
who are going to want you to put down the mobile device, lean over the cubicle wall, and actually talk to somebody.
Yeah.
And where it really becomes important is when you're dealing with customers.
Because
a lot of millennials may be communicating with a boomer or traditionalist customer, and they may think they're on top of it because they're sending 900 texts and a million emails saying, I'm on top of this.
And
only to realize that the customer is thinking, why doesn't this person just pick up the phone and call me?
Right.
So again, you know, what we really focus on is you tend to know how to communicate with your own generation, but have you stopped and looked at who I'm communicating with and then how do I need to adjust my communication style or format?
And I bet that gets pretty tricky, too, when you also mix in cultures, international factors. You talked about customers. Let's say you're trying to communicate with somebody who is in a different country where it is more favorable and there's a slower build, should I say, where, you know, the courtship takes a little bit longer and you want to get to know somebody before you just go for the kill or ask for the order or whatever. That has to be communicated in special ways when you're a millennial.
Absolutely. And sometimes, you know, there's a great place for technology and texting and emailing. It's efficient. It's where you want it, how you want it, you know, and the world's going that way. Look at your radio program. How great is it that anyone can listen to your radio show when they want and how they want?
Exactly.
I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
And so technology has brought us communication tools like this.
Mm-hmm.
However, we've got to be careful, as we say to the millennials in our book, don't let the water cooler dry up. You still need to get out there and talk to each other. And sometimes a lot of misunderstandings or missed expectations happen because we're trying, you know, you don't get to hear the voice. You don't get to look the person in the eye. And nothing will ever take the place of that. But for the millennials, you know, it might not be something they're comfortable with or even familiar with. And a lot of times we don't take the time to talk to them about that. And so what do? We label them as non-communicative, not team players, you know, bad work ethic.
Right. So
when they're just doing it in a different way.
Sure. It becomes possibly a discipline issue or an issue where the styles have been misunderstood. And you mentioned in your book that you wrote with Lynn Lancaster, you have some wonderful quotes in here by younger people. And one of the quotes is, and speaking of social networking and social media, mm-hmm. you say, I use Facebook. This is a 25-year-old senior account
yep.
executive. I use Facebook, but I don't like to use it at work. I'm on LinkedIn, which to me is more professional. My Facebook account is to keep in touch with my friends and my family. And I bring that up because there are lots of accounts now, and we're trying to warn younger people, be careful what you put on Facebook, watch your pictures, watch what you say, because a lot of employers now are going to social media sites first as they are deciding on candidates.
You know, and we've even got some numbers to support this. We did a national survey with the Institute for Corporate Productivity for the M Factor. And one of our findings around social networking was that more than 70% of boomers and Xers said that personal behavior on social networking sites would influence their decision to hire or promote somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So this does impact your career.
Right.
Now, all day long, millennials can say, it doesn't matter what I do on the weekends, it's my business, and this is all true. But if people are going there and they're making judgments, we can't change that. And so, like you read in that quote, there are people who are getting savvy and they're using Facebook for certain things and LinkedIn for others. But the bigger issue here is that we need to understand that the lines between personal and professional are being blurred with social networking because we have access to people in so many new ways.
Yeah, very, very much so. And it's interesting that you would say that, David. I am very active on Facebook and LinkedIn. I'm very politically active, knowing that even with my Facebook account, I have as many progressives or Democrats as I am, as I have conservatives and Republicans who are my friends as well. So even when I state something on my Facebook page, I do it in a way that will evoke discussion and conversation in an appropriate manner. And I think that's what you're stating also, and what we try to tell younger people is that you could have an opinion, you can say something, but it's the appropriateness, and can your information be broadcast on the New York Times or in the New York Times just based on your pictures and based on your text. So that's the main message, that it's a matter of embracing technology but doing it in a way where it's going to not jeopardize your job.
Well, the thing to realize, too, is that for a baby boomer, when you said you're very aware of what you say, how you see it, where you say it, that's very common for a baby boomer. If you think about boomers, 80 million competing, they really had to learn the game of internal politics.
Mm-hmm.
They learned how to challenge status quo, but not do it in such a way where they're going to stand out so much that they're going to, you know, get in trouble and have everyone pass them up and climb up the ladder. But yet they knew how to influence to make change. And so boomers are very savvy about who to communicate when and how, et cetera. But what we find with the younger generations, again, not necessarily on their radar.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying to me doesn't surprise me that you would innately know this. What we can't assume is that millennials are going to understand that game of internal politics.
Mm-hmm. So what you're also leading to is this importance of transferring knowledge, and you talk about it in your book. Just the important. I talk about it as well. I feel that baby boomers have a fundamental requirement to do what they can to transfer knowledge, decorum, diplomacy, et cetera, to the younger generations. What does your research show with that, David?
You broke up there. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I was asking you about knowledge transfer.
Right.
And the importance of it. I feel it's a very important topic, particularly dealing with boomers. So I was going to ask you, what has your research shown about knowledge transfer?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought this up, Carol, because I'm so concerned about knowledge transfer. What
yeah.
I find is that so many people are realizing that, yes, there's a new generation, the millennials coming in, and they're like, oh, my goodness, they're so different. I have to do orientation in a whole new way. I have to recruit in new ways. I have to do feedback in new ways. So companies are spending all this time figuring out what it's going to take to get them on board.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're doing is they're letting all these people retire
yeah.
and walk out the door with great knowledge.
Right.
And by the time they realize that knowledge is gone, it's too late, and you don't have time or money to get it back.
Mm-hmm.
So knowledge transfer is huge.
Yeah.
And there's some big obstacles getting in the way with knowledge transfer. One is that a lot of the boomers are seeing these millennials come in. They're getting all this training, all this attention, climbing up the ladder at record speed, and they're saying, what about me?
Hmm.
Wow, this person's going to have my job in the next month if they keep up this pace.
So that's a threat.
So what do? They hang on to knowledge. They don't share the knowledge because knowledge is power.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when knowledge is power, you're not going to share it. So we also have some generational gaps at play that are getting in the way of knowledge transfer. Animosity with the baby boom. Another one is we need to look at the type of knowledge we're transferring. There's going to be some of that knowledge that shouldn't be transferred. It's obsolete, it's dated, and it's time to be updated.
Well, I think what you're saying is that baby boomers, clearly the technical know-how is going to change because technology changes all the time. I would say that boomers need to do a better job of transferring philosophical knowledge and even war stories that have lessons attached to them so that the younger generations, the Xers, the millennials, can then use that information in a leadership role. So, I mean, we're really talking about leadership information and knowledge that needs to be transferred that obviously can take into account equipment changes and technological advancements that will change from time to time.
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. The other generations have been there and done that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that just as you know, that experience out in the field, that is in the world of work, you don't learn in school.
Right.
And you're not going to learn at orientation. And that's the type of conversations we need to foster between the generations. And one of the best things we can tell, if you have any millennials listening in, is they need to go out to lunch with someone from a different generation and just ask them, Tell me about some big events that shaped who you are today at work.
Tell
me about, you know, you've been through a recession in the past. Well, how did this affect last time? What have you seen? What do you predict?
Yeah.
What's your scariest thing? What's your best experience? And those are the type of conversations where some of the best learning takes place.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it goes both ways. Don't assume you know the millennials because, you know, you've read some blogs or you've been on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Take the time and say, you know, what shaped you? What are your fears? What are your aspirations?
Sure.
And it's amazing how those conversations don't take place between the generations. And
That's,
again, where some of the best knowledge sharing does take place.
And I think
but you're right. If that walks out the door and we don't spend time, where are you going to have access to it? You know, a lot of times this is someone documented it and put it in a binder on someone's shelf.
So
you know, like you said, there's the technical know-how, but where are the war stories? Because that's what we need transferred.
And that's those are the legacies that I think are important. What's exciting, though, that you have in your book is the importance of meaning. And you have a number of conversations here. You have millennials on record. One person, another 25-year-old, says, I love that I'm part of an organization that is trying to improve health care and provide care for patients. Of course, I can have a job that just pays the bills, but meaning for me is contributing to something bigger and improving things for other people. Now, what's exciting for me is that I always heard that the Gen Xers were not as focused on tradition and legacy and passing the torch, but now what I'm hearing is that millennials are interested in meaningful jobs and relevance and making a difference in the workplace.
I think it's important to point out, Carol, that every generation, every person who goes to work wants to feel that they're doing something important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't want to say it's a unique trait of the millennials that, you know, they want meaningful work. What is unique about them is that they want it from day one, whereas traditionalists, boomers, and even Gen X, the model was you come, you pay dues, and over time you will ascend into a meaningful role on the job where you get to do the really meaningful work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for millennials, they want that from day one.
Mm-hmm.
So the pressure is on for managers, recruiters, employers to explain to these entry-level millennials how they're making a difference in the workplace from the get-go,
mm-hmm.
even at the entry-level jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the mistake to be made is that not everyone's going to – you need to make them feel like they're Gandhi, but they do need to feel that what they're doing is helping the company's mission, helping improve customer satisfaction. Now, when you're in healthcare like that millennial on record you quoted, it's a lot more obvious how you change lives.
Exactly.
But if you're putting, you know, a widget in another widget on the plant floor, it's not as transparent.
Mm-hmm. Well,
boomers and Xers, I want to point out, they've done it for a long time, so they know that those widgets go on to do great things for their customers. So they take it for granted and just assume millennials are going to know. So my tip to everybody is don't assume millennials understand how they're making a difference. A lot of times you've done it for so long, you just assume they know. And spending the time explaining how they fit into the bigger picture is exactly what it's going to take to get them all the more engaged, because they want work that has meaning. And it was the most important factor they look for in a job, even higher than money.
That's encouraging. That's really encouraging.
I think it's wonderful, but it's a missed opportunity for those who aren't talking about the meaningful side of the work.
Right, and I think it takes a level of confidence from all at the workplace to not only know their job well, but to be able to share their knowledge with others. And you're also talking about flattening this organizational chart, which typically has been a hierarchical one where you've got a top-down approach. And so this really flattens things out. Tell us in the last remaining minutes about the 7 trends you need to know to survive and thrive. That's very intriguing. We're talking to David Stillman, and he is the author of The M Factor, a wonderful, wonderful book. Following When Generations Collide, he co-authored this with Lynn Lancaster. David, what about those 7 trends?
Well, in our book, The M Factor, we identified 7 trends that describe the millennials and how they are rocking the workplace. And now, when we say rocking the workplace, that can be interpreted in different ways, how things are really being shaken up in scary ways, but also how it's being rocked in wonderful ways as well. The first trend we identified is the role of the parents. We've heard the helicopter parents, the baby boom generation, has been very involved in millennials' lives, and they helped them pick a college. They were involved in their college. Well, what's happening is they're following their kids right into the workplace, and we have stories now from all shapes and sizes of organizations and industries where millennials' parents are getting involved. They may be calling the boss because they don't like the review that their son or daughter got.
Right.
Believe it or not, they're showing up at orientation, at reviews.
That's
amazing. It's really unbelievable. So the role of the parents and how organizations need to, you know, put up a serious barrier, but how some organizations are using that to their strategic advantage as well. So there's upside and, you know, also a challenging aspect to
right.
that.
Tell us about the second trend.
Entitlement. If there's one word that gets slapped on this generation, it's that they are entitled.
Hmm.
And we've got to be careful that we don't start on the wrong foot and we start throwing these negative labels at everyone. And so we, in this trend, we really dive into what exactly is entitlement. Where does it come from? Is it just perceived? Where is it real? And both sides. What can millennials do to work through this label of entitlement, and how can the rest of us challenge ourselves to maybe not see them so much as entitled? And what we say, often what gets perceived as entitled is truly engagement, that this person's very engaged but just asking for things that maybe we didn't have the privilege to ask for, but that isn't a bad thing.
Right. And trend number three, we've just talked about
meaning. We talked about meaning on the job, the importance of looking for meaning.
Right. And
the next
four?
Great expectations. And what happens is that a couple, both fronts, companies paint this unbelievable picture because we've gotten really savvy at how to recruit and present our companies. And so millennials walk through the door and they're expecting these fireworks to be going off because the recruitment process was so exciting. And then they get in there and they're like, whoa, no one told me it was really going to be like this.
And that happens a lot.
A lot.
Yes.
At the same time, we will read a millennial's resume and we'll see, oh, my goodness, they've painted a home for Habitat for Humanity. They speak 9 languages. They were involved in student government. So it's very robust, but that doesn't mean they understand dress code.
That's right.
Doesn't mean they understand how feedback systems work.
Mm-hmm.
Because
or leadership.
Exactly. So, yeah. Again, we expect it or we assume that they're going to know things. So it's really managing expectations.
Mm-hmm. And trend number five?
The need for speed. This isn't a shocker, but this generation, with so much technology, has an amped up expectation around how fast things can go.
Right.
So what we need to do is manage this need for speed. We have to look at career paths. When can we move them, you know, at a quicker pace? When do we need to slow them down? One big aspect of the need for speed is multitasking.
Mm-hmm.
This generation was born to multitask,
that's
and it seems
so true.
Born to the rest of us that they can do so much at one time, but they really can. So it's really finding out that balance of how to multitask, allow for multitasking, getting over our own concerns, maybe even ego, because
yeah, probably,
they can do faster.
Right. Probably slow down therapy also. That would be real helpful. Tell us about trend number six. We sort of talked about that. That's social networking.
Social networking. And we touched on it, you know, how it's watch what you put on there from the personal side. But I think the bigger aha is, let me be clear, we're not social networking experts. But what we are seeing is some generational gaps when it comes to social networking. You hear the story of the boomer or the Xer who walks by that millennial's desk, sees him or her on Facebook, and immediately says, oh, they're playing games all day.
Mm.
Whereas if we do a little, we dive a little bit deeper, we find that many millennials are using these social networking tools to get work done.
Right, and to do research.
To expand that network, to expand research and new resources. And so we shouldn't assume it's all fun and games. And so where is social networking's place in the workplace?
And we'll be talking about that forever and ever as it evolves and changes too. And then trend number seven.
And I just do want to quickly point out on social networking, Carol, everyone's so talking about, oh, this is so impossible. Do you remember, Carol, back in the 90s, early 90s, when there was all this buzz about do we let employees on the Internet?
Oh, yes.
Remember that, the workplace? No, oh, my goodness, it was a big deal to allow them to do email. Then I was like, ooh, do they get to go to websites? And we were so worried about that.
People
look where we are today. Could you imagine a workplace that didn't have the Internet give employees access to the Internet?
Yeah, we've come a long way, you know, but it still continues to be discussed in terms of the appropriateness of emails and using a company system for your own personal emails. But, yes, we have come a long way from the 90s. You're right about that, David.
I agree with you. It needs monitoring. There's always going to be those, you know, situations where it's abused. But on the whole, it did find its place, the Internet, obviously, to be a very effective, and we couldn't imagine doing work without it.
Yeah.
And we are here to tell you that the same thing is going to happen with social networking, but you are going to have to navigate these generational gaps along the way.
So true. And then lastly, very quickly, collaboration.
And I love this trend, the trend of collaboration. Hats off to the boomers who have really raised their kids to be collaborative, to be open to mentoring, to want to collaborate. They also a generation that a lot of their schoolwork, if you go to colleges or universities or trade schools, everything's done in a group. So we've got a generation that comes to the workplace ready and wants to collaborate, which is awesome.
Hmm.
But it is presenting challenges because the verdicts, you know, the questions out rather, how are they good independent workers? What if I can't always put a team in place?
Right.
Or we're hearing from boomer or extra managers, wow, they're in my office all day long asking me a million questions. Can't they just go away and get the work done? So while it's wonderful to have a collaborative generation, it is clashing with boomers who are tight on time and definitely clashing with extras who tend to be more independent operators and not used to all this group and collaborative activity.
I think what you're also talking about there is the need more than ever for training. And as we look at companies and organizations that are very tight on budgets and they have had cutbacks and they tend to sort of trap people into jobs without training them or they cut the training budget, more than ever, as we have these four generations in the workplace, training is going to be more important than ever before.
I couldn't agree more. We spend so much our – what's so nice, though, is that corporate America is beyond all of our clients, you know, who have us come speak with their company or mentor them on this. All of our clients are way beyond awareness now. They say they realize this is a bottom-line issue. This isn't
exactly
just a nice-to-know topic. So they want to know, what do we do about it? And that really excites us at our company.
That's great. Well, I've enjoyed this conversation. It's been very helpful for me as a professional to learn from you and hear the message from you and Lynn. We've been talking to David Stillman, who is the co-author of The M Factor, How the Millennial Generation is Rocking the Workplace. I would encourage everyone listening to this broadcast and those who are going to listen after the fact to go out and get a copy of this book, particularly if you are in a workplace setting, either as a manager or a supervisor, or you're collaborating with others, to get a sense of not only who you are, but also all the individuals who are in the workplace with you who are younger or older than you. David Stillman, you can get this book anywhere, Amazon, at your local bookstore. I'm sure that you won't have any problems finding this. David, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on my program.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'll look forward to staying in touch with you, Carol.
Absolutely. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye now. Well, that's a topic we're going to talk about again and again because it is so important. And before we begin our next interview, I just want to give you a little bit of information about the upcoming May 6th Empowerment Recognition Breakfast, so stay tuned. Most people think of the Empowerment Recognition Breakfast as an opportunity to mix and mingle with some of the most interesting people in the region. From corporate executives to community advocates, the Empowerment Recognition Breakfast provides an ideal opportunity for you to connect with professionals from diverse backgrounds who are making a difference in this world. Hi, I'm Carol Copeland Thomas, and Thursday, May 6th, is the date of the 18th Empowerment Recognition Breakfast set to take place at the Seaport Hotel right here in Boston. And this event promises to be the best yet. We're honoring three fantastic professionals that morning, including Mona Lisa Smith, Vice President and Director of Community Investments for Citizens Bank. And I promise to deliver a power-packed empowerment leadership keynote message that will send you back to work with a brand new attitude. So, bring your business cards and a hungry appetite, and we'll have a steaming hot breakfast and new information, new contacts, and a new way to empower your career plans or your personal path to success. For tickets and sponsorship information, visit my website at www.mssconnect.com or call my office at 508-947-5755. I look forward to seeing you at the May 6th Empowerment Recognition Breakfast. Well, we really hope that you'll come. I'm so excited about the phones are ringing and the emails are coming in and people are buying tickets, and we want you at the event next Thursday. We're actually going to broadcast live from the Seaport Hotel next week, and we'll tell you more about that in future emails, and you just come back to our website and you'll actually see the lineup. I'm excited about how that show is packaging itself together, and we'll do that a couple of hours after our breakfast ends. Well, we're going to take you now way out to the other side of the state. Let me bring in my guest here, make sure I unmute him. We're going to go all the way out to the other side of Massachusetts. We get so focused on the urban areas and the cities, and yes, people know about Boston. I love Boston. People come to our region. But this is a big state in terms of all the activities that go on. And I am absolutely blown away with all the activities that go on in the western part of the state, way at the edge. Stockbridge is like the last exit on the turnpike before you go into New York and the Vermont area. And they're doing some exciting, fascinating, wonderful things out there. One of it is the World Rhythm Community Day that's going to take place this weekend, May 2nd, part of the Norman Rockwell Museum from 12 until 4. And on the line, we have the media manager for the Norman Rockwell Museum, Jeremy Crow, on the line. Hello, Jeremy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Carol. Thanks so much for having me and recognizing the other end of the state.
Absolutely. Well, I enjoy going out there, and there's just a lot of history and lots to know, and I'm just amazed at all of the multiculturalism that takes place all the time out in that part of the state. Before we talk about the festival, I just wanted you to share with the listeners the significance of a Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge.
Well, Rockwell moved to Stockbridge in the mid-50s. This is the town that you really see depicted in a lot of his illustrations. You can't avoid it when you visit now, current day. It's almost like it's the paintings have come to life. So it's sort of which inspired which. Rockwell lived in Stockbridge really until his last years in the late 70s. So Stockbridge area and Berkshires really take great pride in having experienced a bit of Norman Rockwell's great career and life.
That's great. There's a fair amount of history out there. I know that W.E.B. Du Bois hails from Great Barrington out in that same area. So when you
they have a wonderful new home site that's been dedicated out there. In fact, one of our workers, Elaine Gunn, was on our board. She is responsible for kind of getting that move forward. And her daughter actually, her nephew and niece, both appear in two of Norman Rockwell's paintings. So there's a lot of ties, and Rockwell is actually a supporter of that site, the dedicated site to Mr. Du Bois. So, there's great connections in the Berkshires.
That's wonderful. We are talking about the Berkshires mountain area where you can ski, but you can also, in the same area, listen to great music when Tanglewood opens up. Talk to us about the upcoming community festival. I'm just excited about what's taking place this coming weekend.
You and me both. We had this festival last year, started it to celebrate our 40th anniversary, and also a unique thing that we were able to do through our archival collection, which we've recently been in the process of digitizing. We have actually recreated Norman Rockwell's studio to look as it did in the year 1960, and many of the photos that we use for references displayed Rockwell working on a very significant piece called The Golden Rule. It was a Saturday Evening Post cover he did in that year, and it really signifies Rockwell's concerns. I mentioned his support for Mr. Du Bois. He was an early supporter of NAACP, and you may not think about it with a lot of his work that was done in the early part of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
but he was very concerned about the issues of tolerance and diversity, and this one painting that he had done for the Saturday Evening Post, The Golden Rule, he pictures this sort of a multi-ethnic assortment of people, and that was an idea that he had been working on since the 1940s, and as sort of offered a preview of the work that he would do in the 1960s, as he moved to clients that different clients that offered him the chance to depict many of the social concerns that he really was felt very strongly about. Back to the festival, we have created this World Rhythms Day as a way to sort of celebrate that ideal that's pictured in the Golden Rule, a multi-cultural experience and diversity, and we, like you said, we certainly have that in the Berkshires. There's quite a lot. And so our festival actually makes use of a lot of the different offers an opportunity for the different organizations in the Berkshires and beyond to
come together.
Share with us. Exactly.
Right. Tell us about, I've seen your photos, and I see people playing the drums. I see children there. I see dancers. So what's going to happen between 12 noon and 4 o'clock for those who are going to come to the festival?
Oh, it's going to be just a real lively day. We have a group from Western Massachusetts called A Beautiful Future, and they play world music from everywhere from China, the Caribbean, to Ireland and India. They'll be joining us. There's an excellent group that's based in Great Barrington called Multicultural Bridge, and they're really working to promote diversity in the Berkshire community.
That's my friend Gwendolyn Van Zandt.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's right.
And they actually just finished up a great program. They're going to be coming back throughout the summer, a program for kids at the museum. They did that for the school vacation week.
Super.
So they'll be joining us again, and they have a song that they'll be doing. There's actually a seed planting and nature walk. We have a beautiful grounds overlooking the Housatonic River, and so that'll be part of that. There'll be ethnic food demonstrations, and there's some great, that's another great part of the Berkshires, there's some great food out here. Multicultural displays from a number of other organizations, Literacy Network, that does a lot of work for the Latino population in the area, Delancey Street, which is actually based in Rockwell's old house. And then we have dance groups. That was a great part of last year, I remember. This year we have hip-hop group that will be performing, the Fresh Tricks Boys, and the Youth Alive Step Dancers, those are two, and of many. And then something that's really intriguing, we have this artist who is bringing kamishibai, which is a traditional Japanese storytelling. It's sort of done with paper plates that are inserted into almost like a stage, a little mini stage, and this was something that was begun in the 12th century in Japan, Buddhist temples, and has had revivals through the year. It's definitely a part of the Japanese culture. So that's a very fitting aspect of the program, since Rockwell was a very strong storyteller, known for his ability to tell a story in one single image. So that's sort of, we'll give people the chance to see how another culture has
is this going to be an outside festival? Will you have tents set up? Will it be indoors, or will it be
both? Oh, yeah, no, it's making use of the whole museum. So as I mentioned, the outside grounds are just beautiful. We have it lined with sculptures from Peter Rockwell's son, Norman Rockwell's son, Peter. He's a sculptor, lives over in Italy. And it's really a great the grounds of the museum are equally as enjoyable, and hopefully I hear it's supposed to be a great weekend weather wise, so that'll be nice.
It'll be warmer. It won't
be
as cold as it has been. And I know it snowed in Vermont yesterday, but I'm hoping you guys won't have any snow this weekend.
Yeah, I hope it's blowing. It's pretty windy out here today, so I hope it's blowing its way somewhere else. We'll have certainly indoors and outdoors. We have some great exhibitions at the moment too. There's similar to what made the studio restoration possible. We have a show called Behind the Camera, which looks at Norman Rockwell's use of reference photography. And as I mentioned, Elaine Gunn, her niece and nephew, who were models, you can see them just as they were originally posing for some of the pictures of the problem we all live with and the new kids in the neighborhood.
Is there an admission fee for those who are coming for families or children? Talk to us.
There about. Is actually we have an ongoing free admission for children's, which is really wonderful. We've
That's
teamed
optimal.
Up with uh, the the Red Line Inn and Country Curtains and Blantyre out in the area.
Great.
And so they've assisted us in really the last few years offering free admission to kids.
Super.
And
my
under.
Friend Brian Butterworth, who's with the Red Line Inn. Super. So free
oh,
children.
Yeah. Yep.
And what about adults?
Adults, we have an admission of $15 and seniors $13.50. So admission to the museum will give you the opportunity to see all the artwork, original artwork that I described inside of the galleries, as well as this whole day festival. So we think it's a pretty good deal. I've seen people that are very moved, you know, visiting our museum. There's a certain connection.
It's a wonderful opportunity for people to not just come to the museum and see your regular exhibits, but to also get a flavor of the culture. When I was out there last May, working with Brian and others in the area, I was blown away with all the diversity that's there, that you have a very strong population of people who were born outside of the United States who have settled in that region. So you'll have an opportunity to come and experience not only Norman Rockwell and the wonderful work and the portfolio that he left us, but also get a sense of the area. And as I'm hearing, Great Barrington and other areas are combining forces with those of you in Stockbridge to put on a wonderful event.
It should be. And, you know, just to mention, too, the idea of different voices and visions. We have many shows, but different illustrators. That's an ongoing theme of our museum, sort of to portray Rockwell in the context of the illustration arts. And there's a show that will be coming up in the fall by an artist named Jerry Pinkney. He's a recent Caldecott medal winner. And he really tells the experience of the African-American culture in a lot of his works, which are, you know, based on classic literature. He has some original children's books illustrations. So there's a number of really great events that we have planned in the coming months.
Wonderful. Well, tell our listeners where you're located and give some contact information.
Absolutely. Well, they can visit our website. That's a good place to start. It's www.nrm.org. And it's updated almost daily, and you'll find all the event information you can.
Mm-hmm.
If they care to call us if they don't have access to a computer, although it'd be kind of hard if they're listening to the show not to have a computer, that is 413-298-4100.
Okay, great.
Yep.
And you're in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. So for those of you who are coming from the Boston area, just get on the Massachusetts Turnpike, go all the way out to Exit 1, get off, and you'll find your way to the museum.
That's it. Come on down.
Great. Anything else you'd like to share with us, Jeremy?
I think the idea of the Berkshires is a really wonderful weekend opportunity, and this weekend should be that case. There's just so many things to do outdoors. There's great hiking and great resorts, places to visit, museums, food, as I mentioned. So I think it's well worth the trip. And it's only 2 hours from Boston, so it's easy
great.
To get.
Can really make a wonderful weekend out of it, and you can check into the Red Lion Inn and spend the weekend there, and then end up your weekend at the World Rhythms Community Day Festival. That's going to be quite exciting. Jeremy Crow, thank you so much for being a guest on my program. And again,
oh, thank you. My pleasure.
I really appreciate you being on. And for our listeners, you can go to www.nrm, that's for Norman Rockwell Museum.org, and get all the information. And I hope that you have a wonderful, successful day, Jeremy. Thank you so much, and we'll bring you back on at another time.
Thank you. Yeah, I look forward to it.
All right. Take care now. And all the best with the festival this weekend.
Thanks again.
All right. Great. Well, lots of news, and I know that in your community there's probably something very special taking place, too. If there is something that you want me to know that is of relevance to our audience, not just here in Massachusetts, but as you know, Norman Rockwell was a national figure and an international figure, definitely send me an email at tellcarole, TELLCAROLE, at mac.com. www.thebrightlife.com, and we will love to promote your event and talk about what you are doing in your respective area. And increasingly, we're going to talk about not just things that are happening here in the United States, but things that are taking place around the world. We're also going to talk about this really controversial immigration issue in Arizona. We'll talk about that probably next week and beyond. It's not going to end. The law was passed last Friday, and it's really quite creating quite a stir in terms of the civil liberties of people being possibly violated by the law itself and the implications of the law. So we will talk more about that in the coming weeks. But now I want to turn my attention back to a very special event that took place earlier today. We gave tribute, and we paid tribute to Dr. Dorothy Height last week and had Carolyn Gray, who was the founder of the National Council of Negro Women Greater Boston Section here in this area, and we also talked with Nancy Thompson, who was a social action chair for Boston Alumni of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority last week. But today, Dr. Height was funeralized, and I want to just bring some words of comfort and importance that came from a very special person who paid tribute to her today. I'm just really in awe of a woman who, throughout her life, made a difference very quietly, very elegantly, in a stately way, was not really taken aback by those who got more fame and fortune, more attention than she did. She just steadfastly moved forward, whether it was dealing with civil rights or women's rights or equal rights or making sure that the dialogue happened between people across the world. We're talking about the late Dr. Dorothy Height, who was funeralized this morning at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. She was 98 years old and had three different services in tribute to her life. Now, can you imagine what it's like to be 98 years old and to have people from all over the country to come and pay tribute to you? Well, that's what happened over the last couple of days with Dr. Height. Yesterday, there was a special Omega service for Dr. Height at Howard University for members of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority. I had a chance to be a part of that webcast, and I was just honored to really partake in that electronically. And then there was a service last night that's going to be rebroadcast on C-SPAN tomorrow night during prime time, so you can get a sense of who this woman was. If you didn't know who she was, you'll have an opportunity to learn more about that by just going to C-SPAN. And then today there was her funeral service. She was just a great woman, born in 1912 during an era of just great economic strife. Jim Crow was the lay of the land. Women couldn't do much in terms of climbing whatever corporate ladder there was out there. And certainly if you were an African-American woman, you had no chance of really moving ahead because of those circumstances. But she moved ahead anyway, even when the university that she wanted to originally go to didn't let her in. That didn't stop her. She went on and graduated from college. And today, who would have thought that this woman who advised every president since the 1950s would then have tribute remarks made by the current president of the United States, Barack Obama, the first African-American president. So I wanted to read some comments and remarks that he made during the ceremony today, during the very stately funeral that was attended by countless people, Camille and Bill Cosby. Camille Cosby read a tribute about Dr. Height. Dr. Maya Angelou was there and read one of her poems. Alexis Herman, who was an adopted daughter of Dr. Height, was there and read closing remarks. I mean, there were Deltas there. Bishop McKenzie, who was a part of our organization and the first woman bishop in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And she's also the national chaplain for Delta Sigma Theta. It was just a who's who. Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, was there. Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Leader Harry Reid was there, Vice President Joe Biden. There were just people there from all over. Jesse Jackson was there. Dick Gregory was there, and just many, many seasoned leaders of our land paying tribute to this great woman. But Barack Obama said this. He said, progress came from the collective efforts of multiple generations of Americans, from preachers and lawyers and thinkers and doers, men and women like Dr. Hite, who took it upon themselves, often at great risk, to change this country for the better. For men like W.E.B. Du Bois, who we just talked about in terms of his origins in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and A. Philip Randolph, women like Mary McLeod Bethune and Betty Friedan, they're Americans whose names we know. They are leaders whose legacies we teach. They are giants who fill our history books. Well, Dr. Dorothy Hite deserves a place in this pantheon. She, too, deserves a place in our history books. She, too, deserves a place of honor in America's memory. And then he goes on, we're reading remarks from Barack Obama at the funeral today of Dr. Dorothy Hite. And he also says, one of my favorite moments with Dr. Hite, this just happened a few months ago, we had decided to put up the Emancipation Proclamation in the Oval Office, and we invited some elders to share reflections on the movement. And she came in, and it was an intergenerational event, so fitting for my first guest today on my show. So we had young children there as well as elders, and the elders were asked to share stories. And she talked about attending a dinner in the 1940s at the home of Dr. Benjamin Mays, then president of Morehouse College. And seated at the table that evening was a 15-year-old student, a gifted student, as she described him, filled with a sense of purpose, who was trying to decide whether to enter medicine or law or ministry. And many years later, after the gifted child had become a gifted preacher, I'm sure he had been told to be on his best behavior, after he led a bus boycott in Montgomery and inspired a nation with his dreams, he delivered a sermon on what he called the drum major instinct, a sermon that said we all have the desire to be first. We all want to be at the front of the line. The great test of a life, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, is to harness that instinct to redirect it towards advancing the greater good, toward changing a community and a country for the better, toward doing the Lord's work. Well, that's just a little taste of Dr. Hite from the perspective of Barack Obama. And earlier in his message, he talked about the fact that she came to the White House, and I'll read this to you. It says, she said, and we loved her smile. We loved those hats, and she was known for her hats, that she wore a crown, a regal. In the White House, she was a regular. She didn't stop by once, not twice. 21 times she stopped by the White House. And he goes on and shares a story about a pending snowstorm that took place in Washington, and they had a meeting, a very important meeting, of which Dr. Hite was going to be a part of it. And so he says, I suggested to one of my aides that we call Dr. Hite, and she that will be happy to reschedule the meeting. Certainly, if the others came, she wouldn't feel that she was obliged to be there. But true to form, Dr. Hite insisted on coming despite the blizzard, never mind that she was in a wheelchair. She was not about to let a bunch of men in this meeting, just to be a part of this meeting. And it was only when the car literally could not get into her driveway that she reluctantly decided to stay home. But she still sent a message about what needed to be done. That's the kind of woman that she was. She was a woman of action, elegance, and she, as we sort of mix in what we talked about earlier today about the M factor, she listened to the younger generation. She listened to those sorrows. people were sort of struggling in school and trying to get through their college programs and taking tests and still being good sorority sisters. She listened to them just like she listened to her 88-year-old nephew who talked today. She was a woman who was truly multi-generational, and I think it just is so fitting as we look at multi-generational issues in the workplace. As I talked to my guest today, David Stillman, we mentioned W.E.B. Du Bois, who came from Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and now this great lady who has now been laid to rest. Dr. Dorothy Height was a phenomenal woman, and certainly as I look at empowerment, she really embodies empowerment is believing in yourself. And so we pay tribute to Dr. Dorothy Height and all that she means to each and every one of us. And I thank all of you for listening to this issue and this episode of Focus on Empowerment. We'll come back next week with another exciting show. I hope you have a terrific weekend, and we'll see you next week.